Chapter 25. Karaskand. What is the meaning of a deluded life? Agensis, the third analytic of men. Late winter, 4112, year of the Tusk, Karaskand. Crying out to one another in eager terror, the Nascenti cut the warrior prophet from his dead wife. A hush, it seemed, had settled across the whole of Karaskand. He knew he should be weak unto death, but something inexplicable moved him. He rolled from Serway, braced his arms against his knees, then waving his frantic disciples away, stood impossibly erect. Hands wrapped him in a shroud of white linen. He stumbled clear of Umiaki's gloom, lifted his face to sun and sky. He could feel awe shiver through the masses, awe of him. He raised his palms to the great hollows of the earth, and it seemed he embraced all the three seas. I think I see, Father. Cries of rapture and disbelief rang across the packed reaches of the Kalal. Several paces away, Nayur stood dumbstruck, as did Eliazarus a length behind him. Inkiri Gotian staggered forward, fell to his knees and wept. Kellis smiled with boundless compassion. Everywhere he looked, he saw men kneeling. Yes, the thousandfold thought. And it seemed there was nothing, no dwarfing frame that could restrict him to this place, to any place. He was all things, and all things were his. He was one of the conditioned, Dunyain. He was the warrior prophet. Tears roared down his cheeks. With a haloed hand, he reached beneath his breast, firmly wrested the heart from his ribs. He thrust it high to the thunder of their adulation. Beads of blood seemed to crack the stone at his feet. He glimpsed Sarcellus's uncoiled face. I see. They said, he cried in a booming voice, and the howling chorus trailed into silence. They said that I was false, that I caused the anger of the god to burn against us. He looked into their wasted faces, answered their fevered eyes. He brandished Serwe's burning heart. But I say that we are that anger. Kaskamandri, the indomitable Pariraja of Kian, sent a message to the men of the Tusk, whom he knew were doomed. The message was an offer, an extremely gracious one, the Pariraja thought. If the holy war relented, yielded Karaskand and forswore their idolatrous worship of false gods, they would be spared and given lands. They would be made grandees of Kian, as befitted their rank among the idolatrous nations. Kaskamandri was not so foolish as to think this offer would be accepted outright, but he knew something of desperation, knew that in the competition of hungers, piety often lost in the end. Besides, news that the holy war had been defeated, not by the swords of the prophet Fane, but by his words, would shake the wicked thousand temples to the core. The reply came in the form of a dozen almost skeletal Inrithi knights, dressed in simple cotton tunics and wearing only knives. After disputing the knives, which the idolaters refused to relinquish, Kaskamandri's ushers received them with all genanic courtesy and brought them directly to the great Pariraja, his children, and the ornamental grandees of his court. There was a moment of astonished silence, for the Kianine could scarce believe the bearded wretches before them could author so much woe. Then, before the first ritual declaration, the 12 men cried out, Satificos kanata yerishi ankafares, in unison, then drew their knives and cut their own throats. Horrified, Kaskamandri clasped his two youngest daughters tight in his elephantine arms. They sobbed and cried out, while his older children, especially his boys, chirped in excited tones. He turned to his dumbstruck interpreter. They said, the ashen-faced man stammered. The warrior prophet shall come before you. He gazed helplessly at his Pariraja's gold-slippered feet. When he demanded to know just who this warrior prophet was, no one could answer him. Only when little Cyril began crying anew did he cease ranting. Dismissing his slaves, he rushed her to the incense-fogged chambers of his pavilion, promising sweets and other beautiful things. The following morning, the men of the Tusk filed from the ivory gate onto the greening Tirte plain. War horns pealed from hill to hill. Thousand-throated songs drifted on the breeze. No longer would the holy war endure hunger and disease. No longer would it suffer itself to be besieged. It would march. The tattered columns wound from the gates onto the fields. Stricken with illness, Gothjalk was too weakened to battle, so his middle son, Gonrain, rode in his stead. The great names had agreed to give the Tidoni the right flank, so the Earl of Agansinor could watch his son from Carascan's walls. Then came Icuri Confis, flanked by the sacred sons of his imperial columns. Nerse Proyas followed, at the head of the once magnificent knights of Cunraya, and after him came Holwarga the Limper, whose thunieri looked more like savage wraiths than men. Then rode Kinjosa, the Count Palatine of Antanamera, who'd been appointed King Regent of High Anon after Kefaramuni's death. The great army the Scarlet Spires had brought from High Anon was but a ruined shadow of what it had once been, though those who remained possessed bitter strength. King Sauban was the last to issue from Carascan's great ivory gate, leading trains of wild-eyed Galioth. Worried that a precipitous attack would simply drive the idolaters back to the shelter of Carascan's walls, Cascamandri let the Inrithi form unmolested across the fields. The men of the Tusk mustered between byres and before abandoned farmsteads, their lines somewhat over a mile in length. The weak stood next to the strong, hauberks rusted, jerkins rotted, strapless harnesses swung from emaciated frames. The arms of some, it seemed, were no thicker than their swords. Knights wearing Anathpinian vests, cassocks, and calots milled on horses that looked like starved nags. Even those few non-combatants who'd survived, women and priests for the most part, stood among them. Everyone had come to the fields of Tirte. All those with strength to bear arms, everyone had come to conquer or to perish. They formed long, haggard ranks, singing hymns, beating blades against shoulder and shield. Some 100,000 Inrithi had stumbled from the Carathay, and less than 50,000 now ranged across the plain. Another 20,000 remained within Carascant, too weak to do more than cheer. Many had dragged themselves from their sickbeds and now crowded the triamic walls, especially about the ivory gate. Some cried out encouragement and prayers, while others wept, tormented by the collision of hope and hopelessness. But on wall and field alike, everyone looked anxiously to the center of the battle line, hoping for a glimpse of the new banner that graced the threadbare standards of the Holy War. There, through budding grove or across rolling pasture, flaring in the breeze, black on white, a ring bisected by the figure of a man, the circumfix of the warrior prophet. The glory of it scarcely seemed possible. War horns sounded the advance, and the grim ranks began marching forward into distances screened by orchards and copses of ash and sycamore. Cascamandri had ordered his host to draw up more than 2 miles distant, where rolling plain broadened between the city and the surrounding hills, knowing it would be difficult for the Inrithi to cover the intervening distance without exposing their flanks or opening gaps in their line. Songs keened over the throbbing of Fainum drums. The deep war chants of the Thunieri, which had once filled the forests of their homeland with the sound of doom. The keening hymns of the Ainani, whose cultivated ears savored the dissonance of human voices. The dirges of the Galioth and the Tidoni, solemn and foreboding. They sang, the men of the Tusk, overcome with strange passions, joy that knew no laughter, terror that knew no fear. They sang and they marched, walking with the grace of almost broken men. Hundreds collapsed, faint for the lack of food. Their kinsmen hauled them to their feet, dragged them forward through the muck of fallow fields. First blood was shed to the north, nearest the triamic walls. The Tidoni, under Thane Unswalka of Numanieri, sighted waves of Fainum cresting the hillocks before them, their black braided goatees bouncing to the rhythm of their trotting horses. The Numanieri, their faces painted red to terrify their foes, braced their great kite shields with gaunt shoulders. Their archers loosed thin volleys at the advancing Fainim, only to be answered by dark clouds of arrows fired from horseback. Led by Ansaser, the exiled Sapata Shah of Gedea, the dispossessed grandees of Shigek and Anathpania charged with fury into the tall warriors of Setadon. Near the center, opposite the circumfix, screaming mastodons lumbered forward, their howdahs packed with black-faced girgashi wearing blue turbans and bearing shields of red lacquered cowhide. But daring outriders, Anplian knights under Palatine Gaedeki, had raced forward, setting dead winter grasses and thickets aflame. Oily smoke tumbled skyward, pulled to the southeast by the wind. Several mastodons panicked, causing uproar among King Piliskanda's hetmen. But most crashed through the smoke and stamped trumpeting into the Inrithi's midst. Soon, little could be seen. Smoke and chaos enveloped the mark of the circumfix. Everywhere along the line, Fainim horsemen crested rises, burst from citrus groves or galloped clear of drifting smoke, magnificent divisions of them. Great Kinganjahoy, leading the proud grandees of Umarna and Jurisada, swept into the walking lines of Einanai, Kishyati and Mozorothu under Palatine Soter and Uranyanka. Farther to the south, the grandees of Kianadini assembled along the summits of the rising hills, awaiting King Sauban and his marching ranks of Galioth. Wearing wide-sleeved collets and Nilnameshi chainmail, they charged down the slopes, riding thoroughbreds raised on the hard frontiers of the Great Salt. Crown Prince Fanael and his Koyori struck Earl Anferig's blue-tattooed Gesindelman, then swept into the confused lines of the Agmundermen under Sauban's personal command. Along Karaskan's walls, the infirm cried and howled to their kinsmen, struggling to see what happened. But through the thundering drums, over the ululating war cries of the heathen, they could hear their brothers sing. Smoke obscured the center, but nearer the walls they saw the Tidoni stand firm before flurries of Fainim horsemen, fighting with grim and preternatural determination. Suddenly, Earl Werdigin Greatheart and the knights of Pleidiol broke forward, riding what few nags they possessed, and shattered the astonished Kianin. Then far to the south, someone sighted Athgieri and the inveterate knights of Gainry streaming down dark slopes, crashing into the rear of the Kianadini. Sauban had sent his young nephew to counter any flanking maneuvers in the hills. After breaking and pursuing the division of cavalry Cascamandry had sent for this very purpose, the brash Earl of Gainry found himself auspiciously positioned in the heathen's rear. The Fainim fell back in disarray, while before them, all across the fields of Tyrte, the singing Inrithi resumed their forward march. Many upon the walls limped eastward toward the Gate of Horns, where they could see the first men of the Tusk fight clear the smoke of the center and press onward in the wake of retreating Girgashi horsemen. Then they saw it, the circumfix, fluttering white and unsullied in the wind. As though driven by inevitability, the iron men marched forward. When the heathen charged, they grabbed at bridles and were trampled. They punched spears deep into the haunches of Fainim horses. They fended hacking swords, pulled heathen shrieking to the ground, where they knifed them in the armpit, face, or groin. They shrugged off piercing arrows. When the heathen relented, some men of the Tusk, the madness of battle upon them, hurled their helms at the fleeing horsemen. Time and again, the Kianin charged, broke, then withdrew, while the iron men trudged on, through the olive trees, across the fallow fields. They would walk with the god, whether he favored them or no. But the Kianin were a proud, warlike people, and the host the Padi Raja had assembled was great both in number and in heart. Though dismayed, the pious warriors of the solitary god were not undone. Cascamandry himself took to the field, hoisted by his slaves upon the back of a massive horse. Outdistancing the Inrithi, division after division of Fainim horsemen reformed on the outskirts of the Padi Raja's camp. Men cast about for sign of the Kishorum. Then King Piliskanda, the Padi Raja's tributary and friend, loosed the last of the mastodons upon the black-armored Thunieri. The beasts stormed into the Oglishmen under Earl Gokin the Red. Men were gored on great winding tusks, tossed and broken by trunks, split like sacks of fruit beneath colossal stamping feet. From the armored howdahs strapped to the animals' backs, Girgashi sent arrows into the faces of those shouting below. Then the giant Yalgrota felled one single-handed, hammering the beast's head with a mighty cudgel. The flint-hearted Oglishmen rallied, hewing the trumpeting beasts with axe and sword. Some mastodons toppled, pulled down by 100 wounds. Others panicked before the fire Prince Holwarga brought against them and began rampaging through the Girgashi horsemen crowded in their rear. Across the Terte plain, waves of Kianine cavalrymen descended upon the advancing Enrithi. Those watching from the Gate of Horns saw the Padiraja's white tiger close with a circumfix. They saw the standards of Gedeki and Ingayaban falter while those of the Nansur crept forward. The stout-hearted infantrymen of the Celial Column hacked their way into the Padiraja's camp. Then the drums of the heathen went silent, and all the world seemed awash in Enrithi voices raised in triumph and song. Kinganjahoy fled the field. The giant Kojirani, the bloodthirsty grandee of Misrae, was slain by Proyas, the prince of Kunraya. Kaskamandri, the glorious Padiraja of Kian, fell jawless and dying at the sandaled feet of the warrior prophet. His jowled head was mounted upon the standard of the circumfix, but his precious children escaped, spirited away by slippery Fenile, the oldest of his sons. Pinioned between the advancing Enrithi and the fallen camp, the grandees of Kianadini and Girgash charged and charged, but the Galioth and Einanai shrugged away their desperation and closed with them. The men of the Tusk wept as they butchered the despairing heathen, for never had they known such dark glory. And in the wake of the battle, some climbed the mastodon carcasses, held their swords out to the glare of the sun, and understood things they did not know. The holy war had been absolved, forgiven. The surviving grandees were strung from many bowed sycamores, and in the evening light, they hung like drowned men floating up from the deep. And though years would pass, none would dare touch them. They would sag from the nails that fixed them, collapse into heaps about the base of their trees, and to anyone who listened, they would whisper a revelation. The secret of battle. Indomitable conviction. Unconquerable belief. Early Spring, 4112. Year of the Tusk, Axercia. Woolen cloak and furs raised against the rain, Aengalus rode, part of a long file of horsemen plodding across the plains of Gaul through never-ending curtains of falling gray. They followed a wide trail of trampled grasses. Now and anon, someone would find the untrammeled footprint of a child, small and innocent, dimpling the mud. Men Aengalus had known his entire life, strong men, wept aloud at the sight. They called themselves the Werigda, and they searched for their missing wives and children. 2 days before they had returned to their camp, warriors flushed with success in the ways of small war, and had found destruction and slaughter instead of their loved ones. Inveterate fighters became panicked husbands and fathers, sprinting through the wreckage crying names. But when they realized their families had been taken and not killed, they became warriors again, and they'd ridden, driven by love and terror. By mid-morning, colossal stoneworks resolved from the sheets of rain and reared above them, the moss and lichen-crowded ruins of Mycale, once the capital of Axercia and the greatest city of the ancient north, save Trice. Aengalus knew nothing of the old wars, or of ancient and proud Axercia, but he understood his people were descendants of the apocalypse. They dwelt among the unearthed bones of greater things. They followed the track over mounds, beneath headless pillars, and along walls spilling into gravel. The Srank they followed, Aengalus knew, were neither Kikrenaki nor Zuaki, the clans that had been their rivals since time immemorial. They followed a different, more wicked clan, one never before encountered. Some of them were even horsed, something unheard of for the Srank. They passed through dead Mycale in silence, deaf to her rebuke for the unruined. By evening, the rains had stopped, but but deepening cold was added to their horror, and their shivers became shudders. That night, they found a fire pit, and Aengelis, poking through the black ash with his knife, retrieved a small pile of little bones. Children's bones. Though Arigda gnashed their teeth and howled at the dark heavens. There could be no sleep that night, so they rode on. The plain seemed a heart-stopping hollow, a great funerary shroud exposed at all points to abyssal portent, to impossibly cruel designs. What had they done? How had they angered the man-pummeling gods? Had the stag flame burned too low? Had the sacrificial calves been diseased? 2 more days of wet, shivering fury. 2 more days of trembling horror. Aengelis would see the tracks of barefoot women and children, and he would remember their burnt homes, the bodies of the tribe's adolescents strewn amidst the wreckage, desecrated in unspeakable ways. And he would remember his wife's frightened eyes before he'd left with the others to raid the Zuagi. He would remember her words of premonition. "Do not leave us, Aenga. The great ruiner hunts for us. I've seen him in my dreams." Another fire pit, more small bones. But this time the ashes were warm. The very ground seemed to whisper with the screams of their loved ones. They were near. But both they and their horses, Aengelis told them, were too weary for the grim work of battle. Many were dismayed by these words. "Whose child would the Srank eat?" they cried, while they tossed on the hard ground. "All of them," Aengelis said. "If the Wirigda failed to win the morrow's battle, they must sleep." That night, anguished cries awakened him. Pale, calloused hands dragged him from his mat, and he drove his knife through the belly of his assailant. The thunder of hooves crashed around him, and he was struck face first into the turf. He struggled to his knees, crying out to his men, but the gibbering shadows were upon him. His arms were wrenched behind him and cruelly bound. He was stripped of his clothes. With the other survivors, Aengelis was driven through the night, pulled by a leather thong cut into his lips. He wept as he ran, knowing all was lost. No more would he make love to Valrissa, his wife. No more would he tease his sons as they sat about the evening fire. Over and over through the agony of his face, he asked, "What have we done to deserve this? What have we done?" By the wicked glare of torchlight, he saw the Srank, with their narrow shoulders and dog-deep chests, surfacing from the night as though from the depths of the sea. Inhumanly beautiful faces, as white as polished bone, armor of lacquered human skin, necklaces of human teeth, and the shrunken faces of men stitched into their round shields. He smelled their sweet stench, like feces and rotted fruit. He heard the nightmarish clacking of their laughter, and from somewhere in the night, the shrieks of the Wirigda's horses as they were slaughtered. And periodically, he saw the non-men, tall upon their silk-black steeds. What Valissa had dreamed, he realized, was true. The great ruiner hunted them. But why? They reached the Srank encampment in the gray light of dawn, a string of naked, brutalized men. A great chorus of wails greeted them. Women crying names, children howling, "Da! Da!" The Srank led them into the midst of their huddled loved ones, and in an act of curious mercy, cut them loose. Aengelis flew to Valrissa and his only remaining son. Racked by sobs, he hugged both of them, clutched at their bent backs, and for an instant he felt hope in the pale warmth of degraded bodies. "Where's Eleni?" he hissed. But his wife could only cry, "Aenga! Aenga!" The respite, however, was short-lived. Those men who couldn't find their families, who either knelt alone in the frozen mud or raced screaming and searching for faces now dead, were butchered. Then those wives and children without husbands were also hacked to silence, until only those who had been reunited remained. Under the dark eyes of the non-men, the Srank then began beating the survivors into 2 rows, until the Wirigda were drawn in long threads across snow and dead winter grasses, husbands opposite their wives and children. Leashed to an iron spike hammered into the ground, Aengelis cringed from the cold and threw himself over and over against the braided thongs that held him from his wife and son. He spat and raged at the passing Srank. He tried to summon heartening words, words that might let his family endure, that might grace them with dignity for what was about to come. But he could only weep their names and curse himself for not strangling them earlier, for not saving them from what was about to happen. And then, for the first time, he heard the question, even though it was not spoken. An uncanny silence fell across the Warigda, and Aengelis understood that all of them had heard the impossible voice. The question had resounded through the souls of all his suffering people. Then he saw it, an abomination walking through dawn twilight. It was half again taller than a man, with long folded wings curved like scythes over its powerful frame. Save where it was mottled by black, cancerous spots, its skin was translucent and sheathed about a great flared skull shaped like an oyster set on edge. And within the gaping jaws of that skull was fused another, more manlike, so that an almost human face grinned from its watery features. The Srank howled with rapture as it passed and jerked at their groups as they fell to their knees. The mounted non-men lowered their shining scalps. It studied the rows of hapless humans, and then its great black eyes fell upon Aengelis. Valrissa sobbed a mere length away.
You. We sense the old fire in you, manling.
I am Warigda,
Aengelis roared.
Do you know what we are?
The Great Ruiner,
Aengelis gasped.
No,
it cooed, as though his mistake had aroused a delicious shiver.
We are not he. We are his servant. Save my brother. We are the last of those who descended from the void.
The Great Ruiner,
Aengelis cried. The abomination had walked ever closer throughout this exchange, until it loomed over his wife and child. Valrissa clutched Bengula to her bosom, held out a tragic warding hand against the hoary figure.
Will you tell us, manling? Tell us what we need to know?
But I don't know,
Aengelis cried.
I know nothing of what you ask.
Effortlessly, the Zurzrank snapped Valrissa's tether and hoisted her before him, held her as though she were a doll. Bengula shrieked,
Mama, Mama!
Once again, the question thundered through Aengelis's soul. He wept, tore at the turf.
I don't know! I don't know!
Beneath the monstrosity's claws, Valrissa went very still, like a calf caught in the jaws of a wolf. Her terrified eyes turned from Aengelis and rolled upwards beneath their lids as though trying to peer at the figure behind her.
Valrissa!
Aengelis screamed.
Valrissa!
Holding her by the throat, the thing languorously picked her clothing away, like the skin of a rotten peach. As her breasts fell free, round white with soft pink nipples, a sheet of sunlight flickered across the horizon and illuminated her lithe curves. But the hunger that held her from behind remained shadowy, like glistening smoke. Animal violence overcame Aengelis, and he strained at his leash, gagged inarticulate fury. And a husky voice in his soul said,
We are a race of lovers, manling.
Biazi!
Aengelis wept.
I don't know.
The thing's free hand traced a thread of blood between her bosom across the plane of her shuddering belly. Valrissa's eyes returned to Aengelis, thick with something impossible. She moaned and parted her hanging legs to greet the abomination's hand.
A race of lovers.
I don't know. I don't. Please stop. Please.
The thing screeched like a thousand falcons as it plunged into her. Glass thunder, shivering sky. She bent back her head, her face contorted in pain and bliss. She convulsed and groaned, arched to meet the creature's thrusts. And when she climaxed, Aengelis crumpled, grasped his head between his hands, beat his face against the turf. The cold felt good against his broken lips. With an inhuman dragon gasp, the thing pressed its bruised phallus up across her stomach and washed her sunlit breasts with pungent black seed. Another thunderous screech, woven by the thin human wail of a woman, and again it asked the question.
I don't know.
These things make you weak,
it said, tossing her like a sack to cold grasses. With a look, it gave her to the Srank, to their licentious fury. Once again, it asked the question. The abomination then gave his weeping son, sweet, innocent Bangula, to the Srank, and once again asked the question.
I don't know what you mean.
And when the Srank made a womb of Aengalus himself, it asked. With each raper's thrust, it asked. Until the gagging shrieks of his wife and child became the question. Until his own deranged howls became the question. His wife and child were dead. Sacks of penetrated flesh with faces that he loved, and still, they did things. Always the same mad, incomprehensible question.
Who are the Dunyane?